Unique yet common sense opinions on sports. This is Jeff Allen Sports Talk.
All right, it's my pleasure to welcome to the program this evening. He is a co-author of the book 976-1313, How Sports Phone Launched Careers and Broke New Ground. Scott Orgera is here with us. And Scott, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about this great book.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about it. Everyone we've spoken to the past 2 weeks or so since the book was released has been really excited about it. So, you know, the more I can talk about it, the better.
Absolutely. So let's first kind of delve in a little bit because, you know, we also have some folks in our audience who, one, don't know what long distance phone service yeah. was or things along that line. But, you know, you used to have to, if you wanted scores, you either had to wait for the newspaper, the 6 and 11 o'clock news. And then, of course, sports phone, as we talked about, it broke new ground when that came along back in the 1970s. And I guess they had an initial launch that did not stick, but then a second launch that made it something very, very spectacular.
That's correct. The initial launch was in 1972. And what happened there is the financial model just didn't work. So there was a company called Phone Programs, part of Airtime, which was the parent company of Phone Programs. And they owned Sports Phone. They tried to launch this thing in 72, and it was met with a pretty good reaction. I mean, the call numbers were decent, but the problem was New York Telephone was keeping the lion's share of the money for each call. So from a Phone Programs perspective, it just wasn't profitable. And what they had to do is run ads at the end of the score rundown. And the problem there is you only have a minute. So they chopped it up into 1 minute units. That's how it worked with the phone company and billing back then. And if you only have a minute and you have to run through sometimes 30, 35 scores, having to include ads at the end was less than ideal. So that cut into 10, 15 seconds of the 60 seconds. And it wasn't working out that way. So they kind of scrapped it and they went back to the drawing board and figured out a way to come up with a contract where the phone company could get their piece and Phone Programs could get their piece. And in the end, I think both sides were glad that they did because, you know, they reached a point pretty quickly where they were getting up to 50 million calls in a year. And each one of those calls, someone's paying for it and the phone company's getting a slice. And so was the sports phone company. So that was in 75 when they restarted and they took off from there and they really took off running. Right away, it became popular. And I think what sports phone did initially is it showed the demand that people wanted scores updated quite often. Nothing like that existed before, so no one really knew if people really wanted this and people were willing to pay for it. And what they found out early on is that people were willing to pay quite a bit. You know, you had people calling in multiple times a day, some especially gamblers, some calling 20, 25 times a day, and each time they're getting charged. So, you know, once they took off in 75, they realized that they really had something there.
Yeah, and of course, that brings up another point, too, because, yeah, once upon a time, we had to pay for phone calls, right? Yes. We don't do that today anymore, right? So it is pretty unique. And, you know, you talked about, you know, the number of calls that would happen and things like that. I mean, it is pretty astounding when you think of the volume of calls, especially as the service got more and more popular during its time.
Absolutely. And one thing, when you have that many calls and it starts to spread and you have people calling from, initially it was just New York City and the surrounding areas, but then you have people calling long distance to get in touch with the sports phone. And later on, they opened satellite offices in Chicago and Detroit, and they had lines all over the country. But early on, you know, the sports phone crew, for the most part, I mean, there were some exceptions, which I'm sure we'll go over, but for the most part, a lot of these guys are household names, guys and gals that are household names now in the broadcasting industry. But back then they were, you know, they were in college or just out of college and no one knew who they were. But part of your rundown that you'd record on sports phone as you're rattling off these scores or news is you'd say your name at the end. So these young kids basically would go out to bars after their shift. And they'd say their name to someone, and all of a sudden, everyone at the bar was like, oh, wow, I hear you on sports phone. And they were reaching such a wide audience, and they didn't realize that initially because they're in this tiny ramshackle booth, And again, they're at the other end of a phone. They're not on a radio station. So as they started to realize that their reach was growing larger and larger, it was quite a trip, and it really solidified the fact that even though they're at the other end of a phone, they're broadcasters, and they're being treated as such. So that kind of helped, I guess, grow their confidence a bit, and sort of let everyone realize that sports phone, everyone at sports phone, I'm sorry, realized that they're part of something that could be big. Obviously, at the time, they didn't know it was going to become what it did, but they did kind of get a sense, wow, we're really part of something here, and this could be the start of something historical, and it was.
Yeah, we will get to some of the who's who of sports phone lore throughout the course of the show. And of course, the technology, as you said, they were on the other end of the phone. They weren't in luxurious broadcast booths doing this. And they had a very aggressive, plan of updating scores every 10 minutes. That doesn't sound like much now, but back then, giving, how you had to source getting scores and calling press boxes and things like that. It's kind of like being on a wild white knuckle ride.
Absolutely. And the way it was described, it was definitely chaotic because, like you mentioned, it's one thing to have to record this rundown every 10 minutes. It's another thing to have to get the scores. They had the Western Union ticker early on, but it was slow. So they couldn't really rely on the ticker. So they have stringers at certain venues that are calling in. When they don't have a stringer, they're calling the press table, or they're calling whoever they can at the ballpark or the stadium to get an updated score. And this is all going on in between each of these 10-minute updates. And it got even crazier on NFL Sundays, because the 10-minute updates at first were okay, at least from a sports phone perspective. But the gamblers in particular, they wanted more. They wanted it updated even quicker. So they wound up going to 2-minute updates. And what they'd have is they'd have four different announcers, and they'd each work 15-minute shifts in and out of the booth every hour on NFL Sunday, basically to give the gamblers what they want. They want the scores updated every couple of minutes. And I mean, that's where a lot of the call volume came on Sundays. And the announcers who were doing this, you're a broadcaster, you know how it is. You're going 15 minutes with this chaotic, rapid fire style update. You can lose your voice. You have to take a break. So that's why they're rotating every 15 minutes, four guys. And this went on throughout the Sunday football games. And it's really crazy because, like you said, it's one thing to update, every 10 minutes, every 2 minutes, whatever it may be. But as this is going on, you have other people that are working there that are sourcing these scores from whatever way they can. So, some of the games are on TV, they're calling places, everything else. And they're running back and forth with these notepads and their slate, the rundown of the games, they call it the slate, and they'd run back with a new slate, hand it to the announcer, and he'd do his rundown. And then, 2 minutes later, you're at it again. And it was just this really chaotic environment. But it worked. It worked. I mean, for the most part, it wasn't perfect all at all time. But from what I've heard, because we did interview a lot of callers as well, and a lot of the callers that I spoke to said that for the most part, they were accurate. Even though they had to update it so often, they did a really good job with it.
Yeah, and you mentioned calling the press box, and they never sometimes knew who they're going to get on the other end of the phone.
Yeah. So there's a quick story about that. And we left the person's name out, so I won't say it here. But there was an old Mets beat writer who was down at spring training one year. And, believe it or not, they're even on, well, I mean, you believe it because now we get spring training updates on our apps. But back then, Sports Phone would do spring training updates. And I'm sure that had something to do with gambling as well. But they'd call down to, I don't, the Mets weren't in Port St. Lucie at that time. It would have been, I don't have it off the top of my head, wherever they were before PSL. And the person who was calling down for the press box to get continuous updates, they kept getting the same beat writer on the phone. And I guess he was kind of getting pissed off after a while because he's trying to cover a game. So 3 or 4 calls in, he decides to give a fake score. And that fake score ended up, quote unquote, on the air at Sports Phone. So yeah, like you said, you don't know who you're getting on the other end. Most of the time, they helped out, but not always, because you know how it is. When you're in a press box, you have your own job to do.
Yeah. And of course, you've talked about the gambling aspect. You think about, in today's society, gambling now is widely accepted. Back in those days, gambling was not barely accepted. And you think about the differences between now and then, and The one thing that still holds true is gambling has fueled a lot of industry in the sports world for a long, long, long time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the thing is, like you said, back then, gambling, it was mostly the underworld that was involved in gambling then. So some of the stories that we got from the folks that worked at Sportsphone, for example, David Schuster, he was on Sportsphone Chicago, and one day he's just out playing basketball at a local Chicago park, and he has his Sportsphone shirt on, and some guy comes up to him, and he's upset. And he's like, you work at Sportsphone? He's like, yeah, what's your name? He's like, oh, well, you gave me a bad score last night. And, Schuster's like, well, was it wrong? He goes, no, but I didn't like it. And he was just, the gamblers, a lot of them were superstitious, and a lot of them would get angry when they lose. And, believe it or not, they'd blame the guy giving the score, like he had something to do with it. But, they learned quickly that a lot of their clientele was involved in gambling and not the acceptable gambling that we have today. A lot of it was done through bookies, and sometimes there was violence involved. I don't know if you wanted me to touch on the Henry Hill, Jimmy Burke stuff now, or
Please go ahead.
sure. So this was my favorite part of the book, because when we started, neither of us, Howie or I, we had no idea this was going to happen. So there wasn't a lot out there about sports phone. We wound up interviewing over 100 people, yourself included, and we had to fill in the blanks for a lot of the history and a lot of the facts that just weren't out there. I mean, there have been some articles written over the years, some really good articles, but nothing long form. So a lot of our research had to do with digging through old newspaper archives. And what I did early on is I just took the number, the 9761313, and I started looking through old newspaper archives just to see if I could find that number anywhere and then see where it took us. So one day I find an old court dispatch from a Brooklyn newspaper. It may have been the Eagle. And it was an old court dispatch from the 1978-79 Boston College point shaving scandal. And it was Jimmy Burke, who in the movie Goodfellas was Jimmy Conway, played by Robert De Niro. So everyone knows his reputation. And Jimmy Burke was on trial along with Rick Kuhn, who's one of the players, and a bunch of other guys. And Henry Hill was involved. And of course, he was also in Goodfellas, played by Ray Liotta. Anyway, so I'm looking through this dispatch article, and there's a little throwaway paragraph at the end. It says, the prosecution entered phone records into evidence today, paraphrasing, something like that. And it had 10 or 11 phone numbers, didn't say what the numbers were, just showed the listed with the exchanges. And I see 9761313, and I'm like, well, that's sports phone. What does sports phone have to do with, Jimmy Burke and Henry Hill and Boston College? I said, there's got to be something here. So I start digging and digging. I can't find anything. So finally, I said, let me try to reach out to Ed McDonald, who was the prosecutor. And he actually played himself in the movie in Goodfellas. And I find him. He's a defense attorney now in Manhattan. He's willing to talk. And he starts explaining to me that, these guys were degenerate gamblers. And a lot of the phone records showed that they called sports phone all the time. So I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. This is a story about sports phone that's never been unearthed. So we wound up talking for about an hour and a half. I get a lot of details about the case and about Henry Hill and things that hadn't been reported before. And so, wow, this is, obviously you don't think you're going to end up writing about Goodfellas when you're writing about sports phone, but we head down that path. And next thing I know, I'm in interviewing the FBI agent, Ed Guevara, who arrested Hill, and he's got some great stuff for us about the phone records. And then we even tracked down the records to some archive hall in Kansas City, Missouri. They're not digitized because this is an old court case. And they're basically sitting in a box on a shelf in a warehouse that no one probably ever thought would be opened again. And this archivist, God bless him, he for $8, he found the records, scanned them, and sent them to me and allowed us to reprint them in the book. So that was one of the gambling stories that I wanted to tell, just because. When we started writing this book, we figured it would be maybe, I don't know, 30, 40 people we talked to, maybe 200 pages, quick, nice history, some good stories, and that would be it. But as we started investigating, we found stories like the one I just told, and it turned into this thing that's almost 500 pages and 100 plus people. And it really grew into something that I never thought it would. And I'm really excited that it did, because I think now we have something for everyone in there.
Yeah, so tell me, what brought you to the course of writing this book along with Howie?
So this is my 30th season covering pro sports in and around New York City. And Howie, I think this is Howie's 45th. So I've known Howie for just about 30 years, and a lot of Howie worked at Sportsfrom from 1980 to 92. So Howie and a lot of other colleagues, the list goes on and on, started at Sportsfrom. So over the years in press boxes and locker rooms, I hear these stories about Sportsfrom, and as time went on, I'm like, this, why has no one ever written about this? I didn't know if there was a book there, but I knew there was something. And as we started looking a little bit further into the list of alumni, I was like, this is crazy because forget about sports, just any company. I've never seen a quote unquote startup, which technically Sportsfrom was, where 80 to 90% of the people that worked there went on to become well known in their field. Not all broadcasting, some went on to do other things, but they went on to do big things. And I said, this is remarkable. Just that alone lends itself to probably some interesting stories. So, I started putting an outline together. I said, let me see if this is worth it. And I realized once I had the outline, I said, I want to do this, but I definitely don't want to do it without Howie. And, Howie was there. Howie's a good friend of mine. This is his 14th book. So he's got plenty of experience. And I figured he and I did it together. We'd have a lot of fun. And maybe we could do the history of sports phone justice because, the list of names is so incredible. And this is a history that I wanted to make sure if we're going to tell it, we're going to tell the whole thing. And I think we did a good job with that. So, yeah, this was something I've been thinking about for years just because I kept hearing stories about sports phone. And eventually we reached the point where once we started, we couldn't stop.
So let's talk a little bit about the roster of Sportsphone, and you said many, many people went on to do big things, several locally in New York City, several nationally. Give us a taste of the kind of talent that walked through the Sportsphone coffers.
Sure. I mean, it's tough to even know where to start, but especially from a New York perspective, you have Rich Ackerman, you have Steve Cangelosi, Chris Carino. I mean, these are all household names in broadcasting, at least up here. You have Gary Cohen with the Mets, who's a Mets Hall of Fame. You also have Howie Rose, also in the Mets Hall of Fame on the radio side. So Gary and Howie are synonymous with the Mets, and they both started there. Linda Cohn, who everyone knows from SportsCenter, she started out, she did some. It wasn't her first gig. I believe it was her second. She was in local radio for a while, but she worked at Sportsphone. Chuck Cooperstein, who's the longtime voice of the Dallas Mavericks, he started there. Jack Curry, New York Times writer for many, many years, best-selling author, and now he's on the YES Network, covers the Yanks. Gordon Damer, who's on all types of radio up here. John Giannone, again, covers the Rangers, MSG Network. Don LaGreca, who covers the Knicks, covers the Rangers. He's on the Michael Kay show on ESPN Radio every day here in New York, and Michael Kay also, the host of that show, and obviously the Yankees TV announcer. He started at Sportsphone. Let me see, Pat O'Keefe. Well, Pat O'Keefe didn't work at Sportsphone. Sorry, he gave us a lot of good stuff for the book. Bob Papa did work at Sportsphone. He covers the Giants. He's covered the Giants for a long time. Let me see. I don't want to forget anyone. Peter Schwartz, who's on radio here. He started there. Charlie Sloes, who's the play-by-play for the Washington Nationals, started at Sportsphone. King Wally, who was Mike Wilshefsky, who was known as King Wally on Sportsphone. He is probably the w most well-known Sportsphone announcer when you ask people that used to call. He was there during he was on the New York line, which was the main line for one. He worked a lot of the major shifts, so a lot of people that called in would hear him. And again, the nickname King Wally, it was easy to remember. So King Wally is synonymous with sports phone, but now, for many years, actually, he replaced John Condon a long time ago. King Wally is the PA voice of Madison Square Garden. And now with the Knicks in the playoffs, the Garden is back on the scene again nationally. And the voice that you hear announcing at the Garden courtside, that's King Wally, and he was another guy that got a start at Sportsphone. And I'm leaving a bunch of people out because the list is just, it's phenomenal. I mean, and then we have other folks that didn't go into sports but wound up becoming successful in other areas. Peter Newman, who's one of the original 1975 Sportsphone crew, he's gone on to make 40 plus movies. He's worked with everyone in Hollywood. I mean, if you look up Peter Newman's IMDb, it'll blow your mind. And again, he started at Sportsphone. Dennis McNamara was in the Long Island Hall of Fame. He was at WLIR. He was the one that started playing certain rock and roll music when no one else was playing it, and folks even across the pond in Britain used to listen to LIR, and they knew about him, and he worked as an A&R with David Bowie and all these big acts. Like, this is a guy where Dennis McNamara, they mention him and then their album credits. Like, that's how close he got with them. And again, started at Sports Phone. So the list just, it goes on and on. And it's amazing because as it branches out, the lives that Sports Phone touched, it's just, I didn't expect this when we started the book, because we didn't even know that we'd be interviewing callers initially. But once we started to, it was, got to keep going with this because the callers, and your old partner there, Mad Dog Russo, he was one that loved talking about his time calling Sports Phone. Susan Waldman, who's the Yankee radio an analyst, she's got a great story in there. So Susan used to be a Broadway singer before she got into sports broadcasting, and she was on stage during a show, not during a rehearsal, during an actual show. And there was a 10-year-old boy in the play, and she used to hand him quarters, and he'd run under the stage. They were in a theater in the round, is the way she described it to me. And he'd run under the stage where there was a payphone, and he'd call Sports Phone to get updates because the Celtics were in the playoffs. And Susan's originally from Boston, big Celtic fan. So you got this little kid who's in the play calling Sports Phone, running back on stage and whispering score updates in her ear during this play with a packed house. And people did anything they could to get the scores, and that story, I believe, kind of sums it up, the just how much everyone really relied on Sports Phone.
Yeah, well, it's good that you didn't give all the names because we want people to read the book, so
Yeah,
they
that
can,
there I yeah, there are plenty more.
yeah, so we got that going. Of course, you mentioned, the people that would call Sports Phone. You and I got connected because you had put out, I still call it Twitter, but
Me
you
too.
had put out about, writing the book, Memories of Sports Phone. And I immediately thought of my days with working with Chris here in Orlando and how we used to call that all the time. And of course, thank you for quoting me in the book. Probably the only time I'll ever get quoted in a book, but it was so incredible because, yeah, you were. The sports phone was so much faster than the wire service, and we would use it a whole bunch of times until, of course, the phone bill came in. And of course, we're calling long distance, New York from Orlando, and so managers kind of up in arms, like, what the heck's going on here?
See, your story was one of my favorites because a lot of the people that we interviewed that were callers, they had similar trouble with the phone bill, but it was usually from their parents. These are kids or teenagers calling from home, and or even adults calling from like an office or whatever. But the fact that you guys were on air and you're getting trouble for the phone bill, I love that story. But again, like you said, the wire services were a little too slow. Ed Engels, the legendary Ed Engels, who's a broadcasting mainstay in New York for many, many years, he used to have his interns call Sports Phone before he went on air with his rundown because, again, he didn't trust the wire. It was just a little too slow. So it was funny. Sports Phone ended up being used by a lot of broadcasters and a lot of folks that were on air for that exact reason.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible. And then you also look at the aspect, you talk about a lot of famous people have that were probably just young lads back then, back in the day, and they went on to do spectacular stuff, were probably some of the biggest customers.
Oh yeah, a lot of the folks that worked at Sports Phone that weren't part of the original crew were all call or mostly callers, before they ended up working there. And a lot of them, the folks that joined in the 80s or even the 90s, because Sports Phone went on to 2000, believe it or not, they had been callers for a good part of their life before they ended up working there. So for them, it was a treat to end up working with people that they looked up to because they heard them on the other end of the phone all this time. So yeah, it was Sports Phone, the way, and we kind of go through this in the book. Sports Phone was, there were multiple generations of Sports Phone. You had the original guys in the 70s, then you had the crew in the 80s, which included my co-author Howie Carpen, and then in the 90s, as Sports Phone moved from Midtown Manhattan out to Elmont, Long Island, you had Don LaGreca and Gordon Damer and some of those guys, and they kept it going up until the late 90s, where they moved out to New Jersey. And kind of hanging on by a thread at the end, obviously. By then, you had the internet and you had sports radio, you had the ESPN ticker. So by then, it was kind of on its last legs. But they hung in there because There were some people that, even though you had all these other outlets now to get scores, they were so used to calling sports phone that they continued to call. I mean, sometimes, like, listen, I know they say newspapers are dying medium. I still read the paper. So, you get used to something and you stick to it. And I think towards the end of the sports phone years, that's what was happening, where even though there were so many other ways to get scores quickly, you had your faithful folks that still dialed 976-1313.
Yeah, and as we talked about the people that went through the ranks of sports phone, they were pretty much college kids or just graduated, and breaking into broadcasting coming out of school, a lot of kids had to go to small markets, had to go to Iowa,
Sure.
and learn their tricks of the trade. This was like really served as a great training ground, and they didn't have to leave home.
Absolutely. And especially in New York. I mean, it's just such a tough city to break in. And when it comes to broadcasting, you have so many people and only so many spots. And normally, like you said, you usually have to leave. You go to a small town, you put your work in, and you try to work your way back. And some people are able to. But with sports phone, the people that were lucky enough to work there, they didn't have to leave home. This was, and again, in a lot of ways, it was even tougher than, say, being an update person on, well, FAN had come in later, but on any station, really, because it's a little more lax in terms of the amount of time you have and what you have to cover. On sports phone, they're asking you to run through, 30, 35 scores in a 60-minute clip. And you have to do it in a way that the people calling can understand what you're saying. And they learned a lot. But another thing that the sports phone folks were able to learn, and this was something I wasn't totally aware of until we started working on the book, is they also learned how to be journalists. They weren't just running down scores. I mean, sports phone became known for getting exclusive interviews. Sports phone would break trades on occasion, which kind of pissed off the traditional print media at the time, because there was no internet, there was no Twitter. So the only people that could get it out quickly, especially at a very late hour, was sports phone. So then the guys that were on deadline for the next day's newspaper, initially they were upset because now there's this new medium and these guys are in the locker room and they're able to break things quickly. So they became real journalists. And one thing that sports phone did early on, and Howie Rose talked about this in the book, is they wanted to get Burbick, the sports phone guys, but they couldn't get him. So, like, what the hell? Let's see if we can get the champ. And somehow they got through to his hotel room. They get Muhammad Ali on the phone, and he gives them this long exclusive interview, and it goes on sports phone. And they did things like that a lot. They're called locker rooms. And you know how it is. You've been in this business a long time. Nowadays, to get to someone, unless you're in the locker room, you have to go through three or four layers sometimes. Back then, some guys were listed in the phone book. One of the stories in the book, Bo Jackson was in the phone book. So one of the sports phone guys just took a shot and called Bo Jackson, and it was him, and he talked to him. So they weren't only, I think the common misperception with a lot of people that had like a high-level idea about what sports phone was that they just gave you the scores. But the truth was they did a lot more than that. They it was a real journalism outlet. In a lot of ways, they were doing everything a radio station was doing, but on the end of a phone.
Yeah, and of course, it also spawned other types of things, and like entertainment and other call lines that were proved to be very, very popular in those days.
Oh yeah, they had so phone programs. In addition to sports phone, they had a wrestling line, which was wildly popular, and where the office was, 919 Third Avenue in Manhattan, it was basically a corporate office. You have a bunch of cubicles, but then in the corner of this one floor, you have this booth and this little studio, basically. And it kind of looked out of place, and it was. And the way it was described to us is that at times you'd have these wrestlers coming up. You'd have Captain Lou Albano and all these giant wrestling figures walking through this corporate setting to get their parking validated. It's just very surreal seeing these guys walk around just a corporate office, because they're in there doing their own wrestling lines. There were music lines. One of the early music lines was 1-900-909-JEFF, which was Will Smith and Jazzy Jeff. It was the Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince Hotline before Will had the TV show, before these guys were really anything. They were just getting started. And the line made something like $10 million in 2 years. And one of the sports phone guys, Mike Weinstein, used to go out wherever they were on tour, he'd meet them on tour and they'd record these clips over the course of a couple of days. And if you called the hotline, that's what you'd hear. They did everything. They had Dial a Joke. They had Candy Claus, which was it was supposed to be Santa Claus's daughter, who's actually played by Fran Capo, who is to this day still the world's fastest talking female. Very fascinating person, Fran. She was, that was a great interview. So, I mean, they did a little bit of everything. The heart of it was the sports, but they did all types of other entertainment. And we covered a lot of that in the book as well because they all kind of worked together, and it was very surreal to have these different shows being produced in the same office in the same booth as Sports Phone, and everyone, they go out together. A lot of them are still lifelong friends, and it just formed these bonds that, at the time, looking back, they're all proud of what they did, but you don't know you're making history while you're making it. They were just a bunch of young kids basically doing what they could and learning things on the fly. And just one thing about the company, Phone Programs, is at least from our experience interviewing all these folks, they gave you a lot of leeway in terms of what you could do. So if you had a new idea, they'd let you try it out. Basically, anything that could make money, they were okay with. So it allowed these people to be very creative. They worked with the Who, they worked with all these rock bands. They worked with all these famous people. So not only are they getting on air, so to speak, they're also getting to hang around with, these major celebrities at the time. So it was a pretty wild run for a lot of the folks that were there.
Well, I find fascinating because I know you mentioned some of the things that started to chip away at Sports Phone. Of course, ESPN launched in 1979, but it took a long time after that because ESPN was not giving scores on a regular basis. They finally come up with like the 2858 update that they used to run, which of course is now the bottom line. That is something I like to see go away, but that's a whole nother show. But you look at the internet and the way it came on and now apps and things like that, as it slowly chipped away, you said it ended in 2000. It's still amazing to me that even after the launch of ESPN, it went on for another 20 years.
So one thing that helped them early is that cable TV was not available wide. It wasn't widespread. Like, it became widespread, within the next decade after that. So ESPN was there, but not everyone had it. And not only that, like you mentioned, they didn't have the bottom line yet. So they didn't have the scroll or they didn't have the ticker. And once they got the bottom line and it became popular, all the other stations got it too. So that kind of killed off Sports Phone more than anything else, I think. But yeah, so since cable wasn't widely available yet, and FAN hadn't really started, and FAN would have been, I guess, the first national sports radio station. At first, they brought in all national people instead of locals, and that didn't really work that well. So FAN wasn't even that popular in the beginning. So there were things coming along where the writing was on the wall, where you could see that Sports Phone eventually would become obsolete, but they were able to hang in there a lot longer than expected. And I think one of the reasons for that too is, aside from the regular line, they got very creative. They had something called Sports Phone Live, where instead of hearing a recorded rundown, you'd actually talk to a person, you'd talk to a sports phone announcer on the other end, and you could ask him specific things like what's going on in the Mariners Tigers game. And the crazy thing about the Sports Phone Live line, the way it was told to us, is you could have multiple people on at the same time. So I believe it was Chris Carino, the Nets announcer, who said it was kind of like being an air traffic controller because you have to get everyone what they ask for, but you also have to keep the others calm and wait. So it's kind of like a chaotic chat line. And those are the kind of things that I think allowed Sports Phone to hang in there. They also had team-specific numbers. So you could call a number and get updates on the Knicks or the Rangers. They had one in Chicago for the Bulls. So, if you were a fan of a particular team, you could get detailed updates, not just scores, on your team. So they were doing other things. They also had the Quickie Quiz. They started that very early. That was there in the beginning in the 70s. And when they started the Quickie Quiz, basically you'd call up and, if you could answer the questions correctly before everyone else that's dialing in, you win some prizes, whether it's tickets to a game or whatever it might be. But the cool thing about the Quickie Quiz is they mention your name on the air. I remember Jack Curry, the Yankee announcer, saying that they mentioned his name a couple of times. And when you're a young kid, that's really cool to hear. But one of the best Quickie Quiz contestants was Kenny Albert, Marv's son, and Kenny was a kid at the time. He'd run home from school and get ready and call the quickie quiz, and he used to win all the time, and he's beating all these adults. And obviously Kenny went on to become, for my money, he's one of the best broadcasters in the world. And
Absolutely.
he wound up, he was gracious enough to write the foreword for us, but he talked about his time as a quickie quiz caller as a kid. So I mean, it spans so many generations for different reasons. You have people calling because they were gambling. You have people like Kenny, who's a kid who wants to win this quiz, and you got other people calling the sports phone live line because they want someone to walk them through play by play of what's going on in a particular game. I mean, they kind of, I don't think it's a stretch to say that sports phone was responsible for a lot of what we're seeing today in terms of sports media and what's available. Even though now everything's up to the second, just the concept of a lot of things that we have now, it kind of started at sports phone. And it's not like they were doing these things knowing that they'd work. A lot of this stuff, they kind of did it on the flyer. They just tried it out. And the quickie quiz was there just to kill airtime during the day, when there's nothing going on. I mean, back then you'd have afternoons. It's not like now, you'd have nothing going on. And they wanted people to call in. Otherwise, you have staff sitting there doing nothing. So they invented this quickie quiz, and it wound up becoming one of the most popular things on sports phones. So they were pioneers in a lot of different ways. They just didn't know it at the time.
So, do you think, Kenny's dad, the great Marv Albert, ever talked to him about the phone bill?
Oh, yes, he actually did. And Kenny told us that he did. And one of the things that he started doing also is he'd call in from a payphone at his high school, Kenny was telling us. I remember, I think it was the 83 NHL draft. He was calling to see who the first round picks were. So again, it wasn't just scores, it was news. And yeah, one of the common themes talking to all these callers is, like you said, at the station, and Kenny at home, and a lot of other folks in different places. When the phone bill came, it became a problem. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Twitter account Super 70 Sports.
Oh yeah,
Oh yeah.
I've had Ricky on my show actually.
Oh, Ricky's a great guy. Okay, so you already know. So Ricky was explaining at the time, he's living in Kentucky at the time, and not only is he calling sports phone, he's in fantasy leagues, as 11 or 12 year old, doing by mail and phone, which I also did back then. So kind of letting my age show. But
Same.
yeah, so Ricky's explaining that, he's like, my mom got the phone bill. I think it was like $400 one month, and that's a lot right now. And we're talking back in the 80s. That's a huge phone bill, because he's not only calling sports phone all the time, but he's also calling around the country trying to make trades in his league. So yeah, it's the phone bill stories are plenty in the book.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal book, Scott. I really glad that you dug in and with Hallie and put that together. It brought back a lot of memories for me, and again, it is a great example of, like you said, how things evolved where they are today. You can look at that sports phone and be in the ground floor for that.
Absolutely. And to me, the best part about it, I think this is the case quite often when it comes to something like this. Everyone's just going and doing their job day to day. You don't realize that you're basically creating a market and pioneering all these things that now sports fans just take for granted. And again, to me, there's so many different ways that we were able to branch out with the stories, and I'm grateful for that. But to me, the bottom line is, the fact that most of the people that worked there went on to just do so many tremendous things, you just don't hear that. I mean, I was trying to look for comparisons even in other industries, and you have some that, maybe come close, but not really. I mean, to me, this one was just so remarkable that all these folks started in this little booth on Third Avenue, and they went on to just do so many great things. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, it really is phenomenal. And of course, Scott, we want you to sell some books too. So shameless plugs on how folks can get their hands on this.
Sure. If you go to 976-1313.com, that's our website. There's actually a pretty cool video on there that breaks down the book, a little movie trailer style thing that we put together. There's also buttons on there to go to Amazon or Barnes and Noble. But if you don't want to bother with the website, the name of the book again, it's 976-1313, How Sports Phone Launched Careers and Broke New Ground. And we have four different formats, whatever you want. We have paperback, hardcover, ebook, audible, audiobook, and it's everywhere. It's Walmart, Target, whatever vendor you could think of that sells books, you'll probably find it.
Outstanding. Scott Argera, thanks a whole bunch for all this. It was an outstanding read, and hope you sell a lot of books and a lot of folks get a lot of enjoyment out of it. Thanks for your time this evening.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Jeff Allen Sports Talk. Follow Jeff on Twitter at JeffAllen_88, on Facebook at JeffAllen88, and the website JeffAllenSportsTalk.com. And you can reach out to the show anytime by email, JeffAllenSportsTalk@gmail.com. Jeff Allen Sports Talk is brought to you exclusively by Kramer's Salve for Dogs.
Does your dog itch, suffer from debilitating skin allergies, or trouble hot spots? We have the solution using the healing power of neem. Kramer's Salve is a safe and natural approach to help your best friend live an itch-free life. Go to KramerSalve.net to order today with new low pricing. That's KramerSalve.net.